tension on the American campus. Just ahead, why the nation's universities are working out long simmering issues, as we speak with one local Mizzou alum with a unique perspective. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. And now, subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we want your calls on the racial unrest on American college campuses. 549-2937. Also this morning, Bright Holidays needs your help this season. Find out how you can volunteer to help local kids. And The Spectator with weekend events, including a look at this Saturday's new Swamp Radio show, Early Thanks. All of that ahead. But first, this hour, a look at the state of unrest on the nation's college campuses. What started as protests over offensive Halloween costumes and alleged racial insensitivity at Yale and the University of Missouri has spread to colleges and universities nationwide, with thousands of student protesters around the country demanding an end to what they see as systemic racism on campus. There was a recent disturbing incident here in Jacksonville, where students just last week found a noose on the UNF campus. Now, at the University of Missouri, a student's hunger strike over racism and an unprecedented football team boycott of any future games led to the resignation of Mizzou President Tim Wolfe. Protesters have succeeded in ousting administrators on other campuses as well. Jacksonville resident Howard Taylor is a Mizzou grad. His former roommate is the newly named interim president at the university, Michael Middleton. These two guys were part of the group that formed the Legion of Black Collegians at the school. Taylor was the first African-American member of the student union at Missouri. Howard Taylor joins us now in studio with his thoughts about the unrest on the Missouri campus and on campuses around the country and where things go from here. Howard Taylor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa, for inviting me.
And here's our question to callers. When it comes to what's going on America's college campuses, what are your thoughts and questions? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us or weigh in on our Facebook page. And so your former roommate, Michael Middleton, just last week named interim president of the University of Missouri after former president Tim Wolfe stepped down under fire. What was your reaction when you heard that news?
I was surprised. Michael and I were roommates back in the 60s, 68, 69. He became one of the first black students in the law school. He worked for the Carter White House Equal Opportunity Commission, and then came back to the university and has been vice provost over that time. The fact that he just recently retired was a surprise that he'd go back into it, but he's been there, as he says, and done that. You know, when we started the Legion of Black Collegians back in 68, it was over the same issues. We were not being listened to. We were not getting, we were afraid on campus. And the Legion was a formation of, if you know anything about the sororities and fraternities, we all had our factions and our differences, but the Legion was to combine the units, the non-Greeks and the Greeks and other interracial groups on campus, including faculty and staff.
You were afraid on campus in the year 1968.
Yes, it was the area Burn, Baby, Burn. Really, the riots were going on throughout the nation, and at Mizzou, we took the peaceful route of getting those factions involved with the Legion of Black Collegians so that we wouldn't do damage to the campus or to ourselves. Nobody lost a life. We had some issues addressed, but the fact is that over this period of time, almost 50 years, it still persists on that campus.
And when you see what's happened at Mizzou in recent months, the president stepping down, allegations of racism, and finally even the football team standing together and boycotting future games until change comes to the campus. How did that sit with you as someone who was involved in student activism there, as you said, some 50 years ago?
Yeah. Well, I thought that the football team's position was major to it. And I'm here in Florida. I welcome the SEC for backing that school and that coach for stepping up and taking a stand.
That wouldn't have happened in your day.
In the Big Eight, I don't think so, which is where they were at the time that the Mizzou football team, even though the majority of the black males on campus were on the football team.
That's a sea change, isn't it? Today's student athletes, particularly African-American student athletes, taking a strong stand and the white coach on the campus supporting the athletes.
Yes, yes. And that's very true. And one incident that happened between the president of resigning, the chancellor was actually fired by the board of curators because the staff, the faculty also stood up against him saying that he was an issue with not listening to them, which helped support the students and with on the same reason. We're not being listened to. We're not getting attention that we need.
And we'll go to your calls for Mizzou grad Howard Taylor in a moment at 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts as allegations of racism roil American college campuses. So when you say you see the same issues cropping up again and again, do you feel there's been some progress at Mizzou? Your former roommate is now the interim president. How do you see your former roommate calming tensions at the school and trying to address some of these systemic problems?
Well, one thing I know about Mike, he will listen and he will take action where there's action that he can take. He has support of the curators who put him in place. You know, so evidently the previous chancellor did not have the support of the curators. And I think that he can... A lot of the issues that are happening, they want the protesters are not bringing to the table. He's a person that will get you at the table, listen to you, and tell you what he can do to make things happen. And that's what the students are looking for, something to happen. Over all these years, you know, things have happened, but there have been incremental, you know, and regression. It has regressed.
How has it regressed in your view?
It's the number of students. One of the issues they have is they want a faculty. There's approximately 8% of the students are black. You know, there's about 10% minorities, but 8% are blacks, and they have 3% of the faculty are black. They want 10%. That's what they're saying. Somewhere in between may help. I mean, it will help, but, you know, that's one of the issues. And back in my day, we were 3% of the population. Now the blacks are 7% of the population. So at 3% in 60s to 7%, is that progress? No. And we had the same issues. We had no black faculty. Middleton was one of the first black law professors, you know, was the first, you know. He made a difference. He came back and did, you know, that's why he's being trusted to do something going forward, you know. One person can only do little, but, you know, if you get the campus and these entities to sit at the table and discuss the issues and resolve the issues, which is a big thing. It's just not about discussion. It's about resolution that they're looking for.
And we'll go to your calls for Mizzou grad Howard Taylor in just a moment at 549-2937 as we discuss unrest, not just on the Missouri campus, but on campuses all over the country. 549-2937. Let me get your reaction to an editorial that ran this week in the Wall Street Journal, looking at the fact that before the terrorist attacks in Paris, the top story in the U.S. was this issue on American college campuses. And I'll quote from the editorial writer: "Missouri and Paris have something important in common. Both represent the inability of primary social institutions to defend themselves. American institutions of higher learning are beset by an intellectual anarchy that is eroding their reason for being. In the Middle East, unchecked anarchy has caused millions of refugees to flow into a Europe incapable of handling that crisis and now reeling from its vulnerability to terrorist attacks. In universities, the basis of that order for centuries has been free inquiry. Our founders gave constitutional protection to freedom of speech." And he goes on to argue that the basic premise on campus that free and open speech is a given is being challenged, that too many students are screaming that they need a safe space, that their viewpoint can't be challenged with a viewpoint they find uncomfortable. It's a somewhat separate issue from allegations of outright racism. But what are your thoughts about this argument that the ivory tower is being threatened by this overemphasis, conservatives might say, on political correctness?
Well, you know, the fact that 31 state governors have discontinued the importation of Syrians is a statement that, you know, we don't trust these people. Who are these people? Mm-hmm. You know, are they all, you know, radical Islamics, you know, or radical Muslims, which is, you know, there's a difference. There's a difference in America with religion. There are radicals and non-radicals. But the fact that the governors of the states are standing up against the president to, you know, stop this importation of people that are seeking freedom is the same issue that the college campuses have.
As you see them as interrelated.
Yes. Yes. It's the same thing. It's freedom. People being people wanting to express their, you know, live their lives out the best they can and express their interests in, you know, democracy is what we're talking about here in America, democracy.
549-2937 to join the show. Chris is in Jacksonville. Hi, Chris. Good morning.
Good morning. Question for your guest. I'm just curious. Is there any information available to the public as to the entrance requirement for African Americans at, say, Missouri versus Caucasian? And also, especially the African Americans who are, for lack of better terms, complaining about being discriminated against, what type of financial aid are they getting? I guess I sort of speak for, you might characterize as a silent majority of Caucasians who, in fairness, there were many, many injustices done to African-Americans throughout American history. No one in their right mind could defend slavery or segregation, but it just seems like 6 years after the civil rights legislation and all these, and again, for lack of better terms, quota programs where we all know this, African Americans have lower standards, entrance standards to get into colleges, and they're disproportionately given a disproportionate amount of financial aid. And, you know, between what's going on in these college campuses now and the other narrative that's trying to be portrayed by the liberal media that we that our criminal justice system is somehow biased, I think I speak for a lot of Caucasians that are getting to the point where we're fed up with and stuff. But back to my original question, is there any information out there about the entrance requirements for students and what type of financial aid they're getting?
Thank you, Chris, for your question. I think that's insightful from your point of view. It's a state school, so the entrance requirements are the same for everyone. I can relate to, I don't know the upgrades at this point, but when I went there on a Pell Grant. I got no scholarship offers with a 3.2 average and got no scholarship offers. One, and when I talk about institutional, throughout the institution, they did not feed the information to my high school as far as what I was eligible for, which I was because I had whites around me, other students around me who got those scholarships. At the time, following when I left, 69, out of the St. Louis area, which I grew up in, the black football coaches advised their players not to go to Mizzou because of the racism that existed there, and they would not get a fair opportunity to play and to move on to the next level of NFL. So that's still the issues that they're raising now. That's what I'm saying, regardless of, you know, when you've got 7% of 32,000 students and only 7% are black, then you know, there's something there other than interest requirements to keeping them from coming. One is funding.
And I think when the caller talks about the silent majority and when he says he feels that he's speaking for a lot of Caucasian people and he talks about his perception of different entrance requirements, a narrative that the criminal justice system that he doesn't necessarily buy into is biased against those of color. Those are perceptions that many white Americans hold. Now, I think the divide comes from that's a perception that one group of Americans have. On the other hand, many black Americans have a completely different lived experience, one that you're trying to give voice to this morning, correct?
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah. You know, coming from an environment that you know, going into particularly University of Missouri, which the community is known to be hostile and the school is known to be non-supportive, then why would you want to go there?
What would you say to those listening who might have come from a lower middle class white background and their kid couldn't get into a school like that and they feel that their child is being discriminated against because of what they perceive as affirmative action, quotas is a word, a very loaded term, I grant you, that set asides for some children to get into schools and others don't always get in. These types of discussions are so difficult to have when it comes to race, and I think they contribute to the tension and the anger and different groups of people talking past each other and not coming to understanding, Howard. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the issues, the graduate student that went on a hunger strike, he did it, you know, even though he's black, he did it as a graduate student because they had reduced what his tuition reimbursement and his health care costs, which is germane to everybody. You know, he just happened to be black in that case. But that's one of the issues that they have against the campus and the president is that, why did you do this to us? We're supporting the university by grading papers and sitting in for professors and, you know, trying to make a change there to the students, and you take away our benefits.
And Nicole tweets the show, we should remember that what's going on across college campuses is just a reflection that they're a microcosm of our society. Jay in Jacksonville is on the line. Hi, Jay. Good morning. Jay, give us a call back. Linda in Deerwood. Linda, how are you today?
I'm okay. I am really calling in response to your previous caller. I would just, which is not surprising, but it's still always surprising when you hear the old lines of, like, what type of financial aid do they get and what type of GPA do they get? I know it's so difficult in America to hear about the perception of some people, blacks can be happy for whatever they get, and that there is no white privilege. That's just a fallacy that will never be rectified because there are some people in the system that feel like, you know, whatever happened in slavery is over and that there are no repercussions. Obviously, that gentleman doesn't take the time to know his history, and I don't know if he speaks for the silent majority. I would like for him to come to a panel and speak that in the open to people's faces, and so that all of us that work with him and shop with him will know that the verbiage he's spouting sounds a lot like cloaked racism. And he probably doesn't even know or care because he does feel he's part of the silent majority. And that's the part that's sad. Does he have any other people? I mean, is he asking black people to pull out their GPA? You know, I have an MBA. I don't flash that around. It shouldn't be salient. But that is part of the ignorance of people in America and in certain parts that don't have an idea of what's really going on because they're so focused on a certain things that they hear in the media and they've cloaked onto it. I'm really sad for him. I hope he gets some exposure before he dies to something other than what he's heard on the radio or TV or Fox News or whatever he's listening to. You know, maybe he'll ask some of his two black friends to pull out their information and show them what GPA they had when they went to college. Okay, it's a wonderful day in Jacksonville. You guys take care.
Thank you, Linda, for your comments. I am also an MBA, and I went to graduate school on a full scholarship paid for by General Motors, AT&T, most of the major companies that were in existence at that time, who recognized the need to have blacks in higher positions. Thank you.
549-2937. Jay in Jacksonville is back on the line. Hi, Jay. Good morning.
How you doing, Melissa? Good morning, all.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to share some quick experience. I'm African-American or Cape Verdean descent. I actually lived in Missouri, Fulton, Missouri, back in 87. Went to school at New Bloomfield High School or junior middle school. And I was the only black student at that school. And I experienced so much racism there. In fact, I got into a fight with my first week there with a student. During that time, there was like four TV channels, and most of them were all Christian. And his father was actually one of the pastors that controlled one of the channels. And he called me nigger like the first week within me being there. And what I wanted to say is that there's these rural areas where it's majority white. And as the previous caller mentioned, you know, you have these conservative media outlets. I'm listening to Rush Limbaugh on the way in, and he blames domestic terrorism on Democrats and liberalism or liberal policies. And it's the thinking of that so-called silent majority that, you know, they have there's an ideology separation in America. There's two sides. One side that wants America to be the great old America where, you know, the white man runs the country and woman, the white family. And there's the side from us, others that, you know, want a blended society. You know, we have no choice. You know, we're of color. You know, we're of different nationalities. So it's only common sense that we want, you know, a melting pot. And then there's that side that doesn't want a melting pot because it's their perception through Fox News and those other conservative channels that as soon as somebody black moves in the neighborhood, the property value goes down, crime's going to go up. And, you know, it's just a false perception. And then you have these major media outlets that amplify that. And as the previous caller mentioned about the other individual, when you surround yourself by just that type of dialogue and that's all you're hearing, then that's going to form your opinion. And I'm going to end on this note. If he thinks that there is no inequality, I mean, some of it is class, because I grew up in a poor community with poor whites and poor blacks, and we were treated equally by the police as opposed to those, you know, that had money. So, you know, it's a class issue and a race issue. And I'll just take my comments online.
Yeah. Thanks, Jay. And, you know, when it comes to this discussion, I think it might be insightful to talk a little bit about the concept of white privilege. The noted Wellesley researcher Peggy McIntosh is famed for coining the phrase invisible backpack. When you talk about privilege, and this has been helpful for me in discussing this issue with guests like you, Howard, as someone who is myself Caucasian, and for anyone listening who isn't familiar with the idea of the invisible backpack of white privilege, when you think about walking through life with an invisible backpack that sort of eases your path, Peggy McIntosh came up with this concept, and I'm just going to read a little bit some of the points she made that researchers for the last couple of decades have built upon her original ideas. And when she talks about it, this is what she wrote. I can, if I wish, arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time. If I want to move, I can rent or purchase housing in an area that I can afford in which I would want to live. I can be sure my neighbors will usually be neutral or pleasant to me. When I go shopping alone, I can be pretty sure that I won't be followed or harassed. I can turn on the television or open the front page of the paper and always see people of my race positively represented. When I'm told about my national heritage or about civilization, I'm usually shown people of my color. I can be sure that my children will be given curricular materials that testify to the positive existence of their race. If I want to, I can be pretty sure of finding a publisher for this piece on white privilege. Whether I use checks, credit cards, or cash, I can count on my skin color not to work against the appearance of financial reliability. I can arrange to protect my kids most of the time from people who might not like them. I can swear or dress in secondhand clothes or not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to bad morals, poverty, or illiteracy. I can speak in public to a powerful group of men without putting my race on trial. I can do well in a challenging situation without being called a credit to my race. I'm never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group. I can remain oblivious of the language and customs of persons of color who constitute the world's majority without feeling in my culture any penalty. I can criticize our government and talk about how much I fear its policies without being seen as an outsider. I can be sure that if I ask to talk to the person in charge, I will almost always be facing a person of my race. If a cop pulls me over or the IRS audits my taxes, I can be sure I haven't been singled out because of my race. And on and on and on. There's a long list. That's the invisible backpack, and I think that's what you're getting at.
Yes, I agree with that totally. And, you know, you mentioned, Jay, that, you know, you're from the rural area of Missouri, but Missouri is basically made up of St. Louis and Kansas City, and then the Ozark. So, you know, so, and within Kansas City and St. Louis, you get this racial divide that's significant as far as, like I say, growing up black. You know, and that's where Ferguson comes in, where people have escaped from the city per se, but they are still trying to emulate others rather than being themselves and being comfortable with where they live.
Jarek in Jacksonville. Jarek, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm actually from East St. Louis originally, so I'm very familiar with Mizzou, and I chose to go to University of Illinois instead of Mizzou because of some of the things I heard. I want to talk about some of the comments that I've heard this morning. I've heard a lot about perceptions, and I'm always mindful that particularly the person that called in and talked about his perception of the quota system, et cetera. Had I grown up in a different experience, I might have those same misperceptions. So instead of attacking him, I'd like to offer that he goes back and he looks at some data. And so he talked about slavery and segregation being over with. Slavery is definitely over with, but segregation is not. We're dealing with the legacy of those things. But more than that, most people are surprised to find, if you look across all aspects of quality of life, employment, housing, income, African Americans are still suffering the worst outcomes. And specifically, you can focus in on new studies in each of those areas, studies within the last 2 to 3 years, that show outright discrimination against African Americans. Things like with the same credit score, you're more likely to have a higher interest rate, et cetera. Things like in schools for the same behaviors, black kids are more likely to be suspended. The earlier caller mentioned the criminal justice system and how he doesn't believe it's biased. Well, just look at the studies that suggest for the same infraction, the penalties for African Americans are heavier. And so rather than going off perceptions, I really wish that people had that data available to them and they would go out and they take a look at that data and understand the legacy of what we've experienced before coupled with what we continue to experience today. The other thing is we have to be careful about our language. I heard you read the piece on white privilege, and certainly all of that makes sense. But I think about if I were white, and I grew up in a really poor environment, and I just hear the term white privilege, psychologically, I might be shut down because I know my life might have been challenging. Nobody gave me anything. And so I do talk about those concepts, and I wrote a book called The Fragile Mind that will be revised in January. I talk about those concepts, but I try not to use loaded terms like white privilege. I call it cultural congruence. Because what you're talking about is a shared experience, and there's some advantage to having shared experiences with decision makers. But I really look at all of our language around race and sexuality and just all these challenges, and I try to understand how might I perceive things if I were in a different set of shoes. So rather than attacking each other, I think that we need to put some facts on the table so that we can all kind of understand what's going on today and the legacy of these challenges that we've all experienced. Thank you for the opportunity to share that.
And I think you're right. I think very often white folks do react that way, especially if they did come from a poor background and had to work pretty hard to achieve success. That is an important point to make. And let's go now to Dave in Nassau County. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to relay a situation that occurred to me in the relatively recent past. I had been driving home and one evening, and I was pulled over by NCSO because my license had was actually, my tag had been for my other car and hadn't switched it yet. And in the course of the conversation, when the NCSO officer pulled me over, I had forgotten my wallet, but my license, and it was not with me at the time. Now, I didn't even think much about the fact that until after the fact that I was given a warning for not having my license and given a ticket for not having the correct tag. But, you know, I'm a middle-aged white guy. Had I been a young black male, there's probably a fairly high degree of probability that under the same circumstances, I wouldn't have been able to just go home with a couple of tickets, but I would have been made to go to jail and then have to explain myself to a judge in the morning. So I recognize that white privilege is definitely there. It's part of our society. I don't seek it out, but at the same time, I don't try to deny its existence. So I just thought I'd offer that. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Dave. And here's a comment on our Facebook page. I'm a UNF alum and was disappointed but not shocked that people were quick to dismiss the noose found on the UNF campus. If universities aren't willing to address small instances of racism, how can they fix bigger, more serious issues? We cannot separate the minor incidents of bias from institutional racism. So, Howard Taylor, what are your final thoughts about all of this?
Well, I agree with the UNF student. There were incidents such as this at Missouri that caused the ouster of the president. There are protests at the parade, the homecoming parade, where they blocked his traffic and he gave no comment to the issues, but also the minor issues. This has been developing. If you look at the timeline over the last 3 to 4 years that led up to what's happening now, but it's been there. And it continues to be there. And unless the small issues, which the people are trying to bring to light or address, then the major issues will maintain forever.
Well, we appreciate you joining us. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Melissa.
Missouri graduate Howard Taylor, the former roommate of the new interim president at the school, Michael Middleton, and much more still ahead later. A look at this Saturday's Big Swamp radio show, Early Thanks. But up next, making the holidays brighter for local children in need. We'll tell you how you can help. Bright holidays.
Sweeping changes could be in store for Duval Public Schools, including school zone boundary shifts, school uniforms, and underperforming schools being converted into special academies. WJCT's Community Thread invites you to tune in for a conversation hosted by Melissa Ross with Duval County Superintendent Nikolai Vitti and community stakeholders about the direction of our schools. Community Thread, tonight at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
The Clinton administration cracked down on so-called deadbeat dads and made progress. Now the White House says the system is stuck.
When people have orders that they can't comply with, it doesn't motivate them to work and pay. It does the opposite.
Fixing Child Support, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekday afternoons from 4 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Well, their mission is to help improve the lives of the city's underprivileged students and their families during the holidays. Bright Holidays is ramping up right now for the 2015 season, and they really need your help. You can be a Bright Holidays elf by volunteering to help out sorting clothing, shoes, sleeping bags, books, and toys next month. Now, this annual drive all began back in 2003 here in Jacksonville as a small project to help some kids at just three local schools, but it's grown by more than 500%. Board member Melanie Husk of Baptist Health is here now with more about Bright Holidays and how volunteers can take part. Hey, Melanie.
Hey.
Wow, it's grown by 500%. That just shows you how generous the First Coast really is.
It shows you how generous the First Coast is. It also shows you the need on the First Coast. And here in Jacksonville, it blows us away that we work with local schools, the principals at our local schools here in Duval County, to identify the real need that exists, especially in elementary schools, but also in middle and high schools where there are low-income students who are coming to school perhaps without coats in the winter. They don't have enough to eat, you know, so that they come to school Monday very hungry. And they hate those breaks because they're hungry over the break. So What could we do, we asked. And so growing from that, those three local schools, we've really mushroomed now. We have 48 public schools that we're benefiting this year.
My goodness, that is just incredible. And so the big, busy time is coming up. It's right around the corner. You need dozens of volunteers to join in.
We need volunteers, we need donations, and we need more than that. So I'll talk a little bit about that. Actually, the heart of Bright Holidays is that it's an all-volunteer group. And so the board members volunteer their time. There is no overhead salary, you know, office expenses. There's no year-round organization here. We pop up about September every year when the school season comes in, and we partner with the principals to say where is the greatest need. They submit their students' needs, and we do the shopping. So the board members have done the shopping based on counting on donations coming in to cover the cost of those clothes, the food, the clothing, and the other essential items like books that we purchase. So then once we've got everything in a big warehouse that is donated to us every year, we invite the community to come in and help us sort those items out by school, by child, by family. And that's what's happening December 1st through 4th of this year. And so we're hoping to invite the people to come have fun sorting out all these gifts for these kids.
People can go to brightholidays.org. You can volunteer. You can donate. Of course, you can donate a check. That's always helpful.
Oh, yes. I should say that. This is our 10th campaign, and last year we raised over $100,000, actually over $110,000 to help these kids. We are a 501c3, and this is our biggest campaign to date, so I would like to invite donations. I'll tell you that small donations count. Large donations count even more. You can help a lot of kids. And we're actually benefiting well over 800 children and their families this year. So we do need those donations as well. I also will say this is one of the tenets of Bright Holidays. We are really focused on the food, the clothing, and the essential items. But what kid does not enjoy some fun item as well? So whether it's a basketball or, you know, some kind of an appropriate toy. So we do also accept donations of new, unwrapped, age-appropriate toys, again, for elementary, middle, and high schoolers. And so those can be donated as well.
And people just need to go to your website to find out where to drop off these items.
That's right. Brightholidays.org has everything that you need to know about volunteering, donating. If you want to see the list of schools who are participating, it's all there. If you want to see some of the thank yous and so forth, it's all there. So I would encourage people to go to brightholidays.org to learn more. And I'll also say the people who have donated in the past, they know that we are very accountable. So, you know, 97% of every dollar raised is going to these essential items. And so we do a summary report every year that says, here's the exact amount of money that we raised. Thank you, community. Here's exactly how it was spent. So they know down to the penny.
Mm-hmm. And very little overhead.
Basically none.
Every dollar raised is going right back out to help families.
Exactly. I can't think of another, more efficient way to benefit others.
It's Bright Holidays. It is just an incredible local effort, and it has grown by leaps and bounds. If you haven't ever helped out, maybe this is the year that you do so, because volunteers are really needed in just a few days. They are going to be working with 48 local public schools, reaching nearly 1,000 children this holiday, as Melanie said. You can donate your time. You can volunteer some toys, drop off donations, drop off food items, or just go to the website and find out how you can help. Just go to brightholidays.org. She's board member Melanie Husk of Baptist Health here to share the news. And thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. And any other companies out there who want to do some team building, this is a great opportunity to do that as well.
Really is. Mm-hmm. Yes, good idea as well. And up next, a look at some ideas for your weekend, especially Swamp Radio's newest show, Early Thanks.
Join WJCT December 15th at the WJCT Studios as we celebrate the final season of Downton Abbey with a cocktail reception and a sneak preview of Season 6. Reception begins at 6:30 with the preview event to begin at 7:30. Tickets are $30 and include a chance to win a Downton weekend at Sea Island. Costumes are optional but encouraged. More info at wjct.org/events or 358-6327.
On the next Fresh Air, what people do in the name of God. Capturing that is the goal of photographer Abbas, who will be my guest. He's done photo books about militant Islam and has a current exhibit about Islam, Christianity, and Judaism called The Children of Abraham. He grew up in Iran and Algeria and has lived in France since the late 60s. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, this Saturday, it's your chance to celebrate Thanksgiving a little early. Swamp Radio, a live radio experience celebrating Northeast Florida arts and culture, is teaming up with the St. Augustine Amphitheater to present Early Thanks, a celebration putting a playful spin on some Turkey Day favorites. It will delight attendees with storytelling, songs, and conversations looking at the notion of community. The fun begins with a traditional sit-down holiday dinner, then a live variety show that will be recorded to air on the radio later on, right here at 89.9. We've got a preview right now with Swamp Radio creator Ian Mayers and Stephen Damari. He's the founder and owner of The Hippo. They'll be having some treats at this big event. Hey, guys.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And you brought some yummy treats with you. So, of course, I have to give you lots of extra time on the air.
I brought some chocolate cupcakes.
Nice.
With coconut pecan praline sauce topped with chocolate icing and spicy pecan praline.
You know how to butter me right up, don't you?
Yeah, they're made by my good friend Anita Adams, who is infamous for Let Them Eat Cake in Avondale and is now at Peterbrook Bake Studio.
Excellent. And so Early Thanks is not only going to have some performances, it's going to have some food.
How is.
How about that?
Yes. I want always to celebrate what makes this place we live in so special. You know, we get to have our holiday meals outside, which, let me tell you, does not happen in New York in November and December, right?
Yeah.
And so I had been talking to Ryan Murphy, who's a big fan of the show. He's the general manager at the amphitheater in the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. And he reached out as soon as he heard the first broadcast on 89.9 and said, listen, I love what you're doing. And so we started talking. And Mr. Damari over here is one of our food guys on the street. He's always bringing me cool and funky ideas. And he interviewed Ned Pollock, who some of you probably know Ned from Gypsy Cab. He started that with another gentleman years ago. And they had a conversation on stage this summer in our summer show in St. Augustine. And there was just a kind of magic and playfulness between the two of them. And I was like, hey, guys, let's make a meal.
What's on the menu, Stephen, at Early Thanks, this big show Saturday night?
So I won't give a comprehensive list,
no,
but
it's a hush.
There are quite a few dishes, but our basic idea was to do a reconstructed version of some classic Thanksgiving themes, including but not limited to a custom sausage with roasted garlic, sage, turkey, bacon.
Okay, right off the bat, I think you're selling some tickets.
Oh, I hate to tell you, we're sold out.
You're sold out? Oh, my gosh. Okay, but keep going anyway, because I just want to know what's on the menu.
We're doing a modernist version of cornbread. Ned is going to be bringing back a couple of favorites, a Polish version of turkey dressing.
What's a Polish turkey dressing?
It's got potatoes, it has apples, and has a few other elements.
Get right out of town. Yeah. Polish turkey dressing? You're killing me, Stephen Damari of the Hippo Cafe. You're killing me.
Well, we've got a huge bevy of other dishes, and Terry Gamble from the Blue Hen in St. Augustine is doing our desserts, and they're going to be outstanding.
Well, what are we talking? Pumpkin pie? Pecan pie?
Oh, no.
What are we talking about?
They're going to be more surprising. Why don't you tell them what you're doing for desserts?
Well, one of mine, and it's a very Southern tradition to take something that should be a dessert based upon its sugar and fat content and call it a side item. So we're going to have a lot of side items.
A lot of side items and large jars of mayonnaise at every table.
Just give one side. Tell me one side.
One of these sides is going to be our reconstructed sweet potato pie,
which is
jumbo marshmallow coated in a sweet potato mash, rolled in candied pecans, dipped in pancake batter, and deep fried.
So we're going straight from this meal to get our Novo Nordisk diabetes prescription. Is that how this works?
Okay. For those of you who can't see, David Luckin is salivating.
Yes, he is. Now, after the meal, rather, there will be the performance.
Yes. So we're doing a standard Swamp Radio show, but we really are celebrating St. Augustine Thanksgiving traditions. We have a wonderful piece by novelist Laura Lee Smith called Hoppin' John about a New Jersey housewife who's told at the grocery store she should cook something called Hoppin' John for her family meal, and it explodes in her face. We have historian David Nolan talking about the Lincolnville neighborhood, which has an amazing history, particularly in the civil rights movement in America. And of course, I'm going to interview the chefs on stage after everybody's eaten all of their delicious food. And we have the Willow Wax.
We have a little music from the Willow Wax. They'll be playing at this big shindig Saturday night, local favorites. Let's listen quickly. Your ideal man Oh, they sound great. Now, the Hippo, Stephen, you have a new store opening at the new 220 Riverside. Let's plug that. Swamp Radio will also be having its two-year anniversary party at the Volstead next Tuesday night. You'll have a New Year's Eve show at the Florida Theater. For those that weren't able to snag tickets to Early Thanks, which is Saturday night at the St. Augustine Amphitheater.
That's correct. And we would love everybody to come out to the Volstead next Tuesday from 5 to 7. And we're also going to be featuring a lot of delicious treats. Vagabond Coffee's making Swamp Pop-Tarts. And Anita will have some of her things from Bake Studio at Peter Brooks. And the Volstead has come up with a special handcrafted cocktail called Swamp Juice.
Oh, well, right off the bat, you've got my attention. He is Ian Mayers, the creator of the incredible Swamp Radio series. Stephen Damari, founder and owner of The Hippo. And listen for Early Thanks here on our airwaves very soon. I'm not sure of the air date, but it's coming up soon.
Thanksgiving, I believe.
Is it on Thanksgiving Day? Perfect. Now, guys, have a great show. And by the way, thanks for the treats. We'll be eating those in about, 4 minutes. But before we do that, our own music director, David Luckin, has a very special Early Thanks treat, a Bob Dylan giveaway. David, what do we have?
Bob Dylan bootleg number 12. From 1965 to 1966, Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61 Revisited. All the different versions you've never heard before. It's in a 2-CD set, a 6-CD set, and an 18-CD set, which is everything he ever recorded in that period. We've got a sampler thanks to Sony Legacy in New York. They are so good to us. They always give us these things to give away. And here's a little Bob Dylan. Guess I'm your dear. God knows when, but you're doing it again. Better duck down the alleyway.
looking for a new friend. A man in a coonskin cap and a pig pen wants $7 bills. You only got 10.
There you go. You got a $7 bill there, guys?
We will pick one winner at random, and you will get this free CD in the mail. It's the Bootleg Series Volume 12, Bob Dylan, 1965-66, the cutting-edge sampler. If you want this, email us right now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And our own Sean Birch will pick a winner at random. I promise you, he picks them randomly. And this is a great, great, this is a great one, David.
Well, it's a song.
You always have good ones, but this is a really good one.
This is great because they're all the songs you know, but they're really done differently. I mean, just alternate versions all over the place. So it's fun to listen to because you think you know it, and then it's like, whoa, that's a bit different.
And here come the emails now. It's been a great show. Thanks for being here, everybody. That's our program. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on Diane Rehm, the hunt continues for those behind the Paris attacks as a growing number of regional and world powers agree on the need to unite against ISIS. Diane and guests discuss the prospects for an international coalition and the strategies on the table. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.